involve colonoscopies, antibiotics for sinus infections, and end-of-life cancer treatment. The group say cutting back on these things is not rationing, it's reducing care that has no value for patients. Richard Knox, NPR News.
In the capital of Somalia, Al-Shabaab rebels are claiming responsibility for a suicide bomb blast at the National Theater, which killed at least six people. Authorities say the dead include the directors of Somalia's Olympic Committee and its soccer federation. The Associated Press is reporting that Greece's Track and Field Federation is suspending all sports operations after Greece made deep cuts in state funding as part of its broad austerity measures. The suspension comes just a month before Greece holds the Olympic flame lighting ceremony in ancient Olympia for the 2012 London Games. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org.
Illinois Public Media's spring fundraising drive starts in a few weeks, and we want to keep the drive short and our member support strong. So for every $25,000 we raise before April 13th, we'll deduct a full day from the drive. It's our way of thanking you for helping us reach the April goal of raising $250,000 in membership support. Please do your part to shorten this drive by contributing online right now at willpledge.org. Thanks so much.
Support for WILL comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine tastings on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. This Saturday's tasting features Lisa Odom of Maverick Wines with new arrivals from South Africa, followed by live music from 7 to 9 by Mean Lids.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls. We were going to talk in this part of the show with poet Toy Durricott from the University of Pennsylvania. She was coming here to give a talk and a reading as part of the CAR series. Her travel plans got sort of disrupted, so she wasn't able to be here in time to be with us for this program. But I do want folks here in Champaign-Urbana to know that the reading is still going to happen. She'll be making an appearance at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner this afternoon at 4:30, and it's open to the public, and anybody who would like to hear her read is certainly welcome to stop by. Then we'll set her down in the studio, we'll talk with her about her writing, and we'll have that for you on another day. So then, in this part of the show, we'll be going to the Focus Archives for a past program, so that means during this hour, we'll not be taking calls. India is home to a third of the world's poor. It is also one of the world's fastest-growing economies. Our guest for this hour, Catherine Boo, says that she wanted to understand who gets out of poverty, who doesn't, and why. And she went looking for answers in a place called Anawadi. It's a makeshift settlement that exists right beside the luxury hotels near Mumbai, India's airport. And this morning in this hour of the show, she'll tell us about some of her experiences collected over a period of several years, experiences that went into her new book, and the title is Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. Random House is the publisher. It's recently come out and getting a lot of attention, and we're really pleased that she could spend some time talking with us this morning. She's currently traveling around the country talking about the book and is in Minneapolis this morning. Just a little bit more about her. Catherine Boo is a staff writer at The New Yorker, a former reporter and editor for The Washington Post. Her reporting has been awarded a Pulitzer Prize, a MacArthur Genius Grant, and a National Magazine Award for feature writing. And over the last 10 years, she's divided her time between the United States and India, and she's joining us this morning. And Catherine Boo, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
Good.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. It's just a remarkable piece of reporting, I have to say, and the kind of thing that you don't read every day. You felt that in India, with as much reporting as there has been done about the country and its culture and its booming economy, clearly you felt that there was a story that hadn't been told.
I did, I guess. I felt that the kind of work that I've done in the United States that blends immersion journalism, following people over a long period of time, blends that kind of reporting with documents-based investigative reporting. I felt that could help me understand a little better what was actually going on for historically poor people at a moment when India was and is the second fastest growing economy in the planet.
Yeah. If people want to if they have internet access and they go to the website of the New Yorker magazine, they can see a little video with images of Anawadi and some of the people who live there, so that they can at least get a little idea of what the place is like. But, you know, if you could now, with the wave of the hand, you could pick us up and take us there and put us down in the middle of Anawadi, what would be the first thing that would strike you?
Well, I will describe what I saw first in 2007 when I first came. So if you can imagine, you're flying into the Mumbai Airport, International Airport. You make a left. And there's a long wall that which is covered with advertisements to serve the people coming in and out of the airport. And the wall says, "Beautiful Forevers, Beautiful Forevers, Beautiful Forevers." It's an advertisement for Italianate ceramic floor tile. And there's a break in the wall, and you go through it, and it's a rocky road, and you make another left, and you open up into this thriving community, this massive community where people live, often tend to a hut, on top of a hut or outside a hut, in this community of narrow slum lanes. And what's most distinctive about this community is that it all is essentially beachfront property, because it sits on this enormous lake of sewage and petrochemicals. And in this open space in front of the lake, people are doing whatever they possibly can to make a living in the new global economy. Many of them are buying and selling garbage. Some of them are threading marigolds on strings to sell in traffic. Some are sewing quilts. Some of them are cranking gears in a plastic molding factory. But almost nobody in this community has permanent work. In fact, 6 out of 3,000 people have permanent work. And everybody knows who those 6 are. They're famous in the community.
And probably not loved by a lot of people.
Yeah, there's a little envy, yeah. Yeah.
That's one of the things that I think is striking about the story that you tell, that on the one hand, there does seem to be this real, genuine spirit of aspiration, in the sense that people think, or at least a lot of people think, that there is a ladder, it can be climbed, and that they're working on that. At the same time, there does not seem to be, in the hearts of a lot of people, this sort of feeling like, well, we're all in this together. Because people who are doing better, and there's one family in particular that's very important to the story, there is a lot of resentment of people who are doing better.
Right. I mean, the competition is brutal. And let me, here's an example of one way that some people in Anawadi make a living. Mm-hmm. They go out to a place called the Naka at dawn, and they compete to be with other potential day laborers to get picked up by construction crews who need a hand. And so you have, in this one corner, you might have 1,000 people waiting for, maybe it's 200 jobs. And, in people are sucking in their stomachs and flexing their arms and hoping they're going to be the ones to be chosen. And I think that's, it's in this market global economy we have now, where in whether it's in the United States or in India, fewer people have permanent, stable work. It's difficult. You're competing against the people all around you, and it's difficult to step back and say, well, that's an issue of markets and governments. Instead, you think these other people waiting to be picked are my problem. Hmm. And I think that gets into your head.
And I want to make sure people heard you clearly. You did say 1,000 people.
Right.
Standing there. It's like, there are places in this country where people stand on street corners hoping to get day labor, and you might have 5, 6, 8 guys.
Right.
You did say 1,000 people.
I did. It's nobody wants to be the one, in fact, the majority, who slinks home at 11 o'clock in the morning, unchosen.
The Anawadi sits on property that it belongs to the, I believe it belongs to the Mumbai Airport Authority.
Right. The Airports Authority of India, yes.
So these people are squatting. This is not a legal settlement.
Right.
Where the people, and I assume that there are people who were born there, but for people who didn't, where did they come from?
Well, the first people to to start the slum, when it was just bamboo poles and tarpaulin, there were people from Tamil Nadu in South India. But over time, many, many more migrants have come from the poor northern states. So it's mostly so it's really an all India mashup now at this point. And there are people from all over, from all manner of subcastes and castes, and a few Muslim families, a few Christian families, but mainly Hindu. But even among the Hindus, the varieties of practice and culture are so diverse that that you can go on a, on one slum lane, you really may have 8 or 12 different cultures.
And did people who have come there from wherever they had come, do they indeed think that, as for us going there, we'd see the conditions where people live and the way that they live, we would think that that was very, very bad. For though people who came there, do they regard that as indeed a step up the ladder?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let me describe what's around Anawadi. Uh-huh. Anawadi is encircled by 5 luxury hotels in addition to the airport. So there's a Hyatt, there's a Sheraton Grand Murata, there's a hotel that Intercontinental. So people have come from rural areas that some of them have had issues with drought, some with flooding, very, very difficult places to work. There's one woman, Asha, I talk about when I went home with her to her native village in Vidarbha, which is a part of India that's become international shorthand for the desperation of rural poverty because of the farmer suicides there. When I went home with Asha, some of her relatives walked on all fours. They were so bent from agricultural labor. So to people coming from places like Vidarbha, Mumbai, and Anawadi, with all this wealth surrounding it, is amazing. It's not just better. It's elating in its sense of possibilities, because people do feel very strongly that there's a chance for them to cross over from the world of the slum to the world of the wealthy.
I'm sure that there aren't very many people who make that crossover, but how many people do manage to, say, move from the slum to whatever is the next place up that you can go?
In the course of my reporting, let me just say that people remember. There are several people who are remembered in Anawadi for having made that jump. And if those people have left the slum, and people really aren't sure where they went, but it's at least a sort of an electric lore that it happened. And in the course of my book, there will be someone who does find, if not a way out of the slum, but a way to essentially middle class status. And I write about that, but I don't want to say.
Okay.
But I will say that for many people, there are 3 ways out of poverty from their point of view. One is education, one is finding a small entrepreneurial niche, and the other way is getting a part of, being part of the politics and corruption that's going around the city and getting a small piece of that corruption for themselves.
Let me just introduce a guest for this hour, Catherine Boot. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker, a former reporter and editor at The Washington Post. We're talking about her first book. It is Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. It's just come out, published by Random House, based on her experiences over a period of several years, spending almost every day talking with people in this place, Anawadi, which is located, as she explained, right in an area that's very near the Mumbai International Airport and very close up to some very luxurious hotels where people live very well. And it's about the lives of the people who live in Anawadi. Initially, I know that you spent as much time as you could there and trying to meet people and looking at different people and how they live. And eventually, one particular family got your attention and emerges as their story is really central to the book. Everything kind of revolves around them, the Hussein family. Tell us about them.
Well, I would say that the two families interest me in this book, and they're very different, and they come together in a very terrible way. Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking about Asha.
Indeed, yes.
But the Hussein family is fascinating to me because it's a family of 11. And when I first came to Anawadi, I would always be stepping past the eldest son, Abdul, on my way to follow other families. And he had his head down day and night sorting rich people's garbage. And he almost never spoke. But I became fascinated by him because with the things that people threw away, for instance, torn paper luggage tags, snarled cassette tapes, empty water bottles, old newspapers, with this detritus of the richer city, he'd been managing to single-handedly support his family of 11. He'd been doing the work since he was around six because his father was ill. And not only had he brought his family to subsistence, but they had one of the most hopeful prospects in all of the slum. And they had, in January, they put down a small deposit on a piece of land outside the city where they thought that they would be able to go and have their own land, not just be squatters. And so when I first met him, and that's where the book begins, in that hopeful moment for him. And the reason that he was doing so well is because recyclable garbage is so sensitive to global markets. And so when I first met him, he and other people who traded in garbage were having unprecedented profits because of the Beijing Olympics, because construction in advance of the Olympics had sent the price of recyclable, particularly recyclable metal, soaring.
Talk some more about how it is that he was doing this and how it is that then other people were making something of a living, first of all, by picking through stuff that people threw away, looking for something that had some value to be recycled, and then they would come to him. And he was the guy who would buy it from them and then would engage in the sorting and figure out, you know, who it was that would give him money for that. How did this whole thing work?
Well, every morning at the Mumbai airport, or in the slums around the Mumbai airport, you have thousands of scavengers, waste pickers, who fan out. You know, they just searching everywhere, in sewers, in dumpsters, all around the airport area for this recyclable goods, and they sell those goods by the kilo to a person like Abdul, who's a middleman, and Abdul then takes all the garbage that he's bought to some of the larger recycling plants across the city. Some people will know Dharavi. There's 90 Feet Road in Dharavi. He will take his purchased waste to these big recyclers. But before he can do that, he has to sort it into all manner of metal categories, plastic categories, paper categories, and the like. And one of the reasons that he had become so good is that he'd been sorting trash and identifying what it was made of for so long, since he was 6 years old, that his muscles had developed around his labor. And he was essentially a sorting machine. And even in his own family, he was treated as sort of a phenomenal worker. And because he was so good, he had allowed his brothers and sisters to develop more of their personalities. So his younger brothers and sisters were more charming. They were more playful. But it took a long time for me watching Abdul and getting to know him very, very slowly to realize that he actually had quite an astonishing view of the world.
Mm. Yeah, it's remarkable, this story about how he literally had such a feel for the material, the stuff that he has to go through, and that how he learned that, so that he would know from the feel of something, from the smell of something,
the smell of plastic.
You can tell, from this, it's like fine wine. You can tell the smell of good plastic, and that's just
right. And he always says it's the fresh smell of polyurethane. That's just
remarkable and it's something that that facility, he developed that, and that was really important for his being successful and for the family to be successful.
Right, and of course, when you work in garbage, you also know that the filth that it turns in the air can shorten your life, can damage your lungs. And his own father was unable to work because he had tuberculosis, like many people in the slum, and the damage that it done to his lungs was combined with the damage from inhaling the filth of garbage. So his own father was an example every day to him of how his work life might be short. Mm. But all the scavengers around the airport, their lives were even shorter than any garbage trader like Abdul. And so all around him was a reminder that the work that they were doing might well kill them.
Yeah. This family is Muslim, and there are very, very few, just a handful of Muslims. Most of the people who lived in Anwadi were Hindu. So that would certainly could be one issue for one point of conflict. That, and though maybe, as we said, the bigger point of conflict was, here was a family that among the people who lived there in Anwadi was doing pretty well. And you'd think both of those things together could definitely be sources for resentment and friction between them and their neighbors.
Right, right. And the book begins with a horrible tragedy in which Abdul and his father and his sister are falsely accused, and at the root of it, as I try to explore, is not just what you might expect, the Hindu-Muslim resentments, but that at the heart of it was economic envy for this family that had suddenly been able to accomplish what every other family in the slum was dreaming of, which is, it begins with the simple fact that the mother, Zerenisa Hussein, Abdul's mother, decides she's going to put in a ceramic floor, tiles like the ones on the wall that say beautiful forever, beautiful forever, beautiful forever.
Hmm. How does the government feel about Anwadi? What's the official sort of position on this place?
Oh, I, the politicians depend on places like Anwadi for votes. Mm. So, in India, unlike America, poor people vote and rich people don't. So they have a certain amount of political power in their standing and their right to exist as settlements. But what I try to show in the course of the book is that at a time when so much of India has changed, and the wealthy and the middle class have been successfully, to a certain point, successfully fighting against corruption, that more and more of the worst excesses of corruption are happening at the lower level, where people are not tweeting, they're not taking to the public square, they're not organizing. So what I try to show is a world in which each time someone at Anwadi gets ahead, there's often very powerful government forces, mm-hmm. often illegal but not always, that are abrading their ability to give their families some kind of a dignified life.
And is government doing anything for them? What does government do for them?
There are many, many pro-poor policies and educational programs, but what I try to show using my investigative documents work in the book is to show something that I've also found in lower-income communities in the United States, which is that so much of what is on the books presented as opportunity to the low-income people looks very different when you get to those communities themselves. For instance, there was an enormous amount of money for education going around, but once I started following the money, it turned out that a great deal of it was really just circulating amongst the political elite.
Mm.
I use videotape as one of my reporting tools. And one thing, there was people were sometimes very excited to see the video camera, and a lot of the kids in the slum were using it as well. But one thing that happened early on that I couldn't quite figure out is that there were some adults. They were like, "Can we use your camera?" And they would get the camera and they would, or try to get it and take pictures of children with books. And I realized they wanted to use the videotape to pretend that they had a school so that they could apply for government money. Because there was so much money going around and there was so much corruption that basically all you needed is a few pictures of kids learning.
Hmm.
And you could have a school. And those schools didn't really exist on the ground.
Just very quickly, let me introduce our guest. We're talking with Catherine Boo. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, New Yorker magazine. And we're talking about what you will find in her new book, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. It's published by Random House. She's traveling around the country talking about the book, and we're pleased to have her with us. We have someone here, line number two, to talk with. Hello.
Hi, that's me.
Yes.
There's a little problem with the feed, so I'm having to turn you off and get out of the tape delay. I was wondering, I know this is sort of a story being told, but what about statistics? You mentioned the suicide of farmers. How much of this development are people in the Mumbai region? How many people come from distances? And let's see, the other question I had was these jobs, quote unquote, this picking had been the province of Dalits, the so-called untouchables.
Right.
Now are politically enfranchised somewhat. But I'm wondering just how people kind of resolve that in their own minds or something. I guess they can call it recycling, and that makes it a little bit
right.
Trash picking, but it's
Well, I mean, in terms of statistics, part of what I'm looking at in the book is the way in which what official statistics show and may be different from what is actually experiencing on the ground. So I look at how on specific levels. Individual cases, say of homicide, become tuberculosis deaths and that kind of thing. So looking at on a granular way at how what the data is that contribute to the statistics. But in terms of the size of Greater Mumbai now, well, first of all, nobody has a good count, but the usual figure is that it's 16 million, approaching 18 million people. So it's one of the largest greater metropolitan areas in the world. And most of the migration now comes from North India. The really interesting question, though, is about caste.
Excuse me for interrupting, but how distant are we talking about? You say North India, that means?
Well, it's for some people, it's a three-day train ride to get to Mumbai.
Okay.
Yeah, and you were going on to talk about this the caste.
Right. What was fascinating to me is that I had assumed when I started following people who were working with trash for a living that most of them would be Dalits from the traditional waste picker caste. What I found was that so many people had realized there was so little other work, and for many people. It was gathering trash at the lowest barriers to entry as a job. And so that people from all castes were competing with people like the Matangs for their, people who had historically gathered garbage. And so for the people who had done this over generations, they were appalled because the competition was every day more and more brutal. And one of the reasons that people come to the city, whether they're low caste or even high caste, is that you can get away from some of the expectations that you would have in the village about what work you do in your caste and how you behave in your caste. And so people were taking some people felt of high caste, actually, or higher caste, felt liberated, that they were able to do the work of collecting garbage, particularly when prices were high.
I guess that gets most of what I was, but anything you can say about the way the countryside is sort of being, I wouldn't say depopulated, but even more immiserated, and this debt cycle that causes these farmer suicides. And
I talk about that in the book, and as I will quote Abdul, a young man who sorts garbage. He says it's about Mumbai. It's hard for outsiders sometimes, and terrible too, but also better than anywhere else.
In this hour of focus, our guest is Catherine Boo. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a former reporter and editor for The Washington Post. Her reporting has been awarded a Pulitzer Prize. Her new book, which is just out now, is Behind the Beautiful Forever's Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. Random House is the publisher. She is on the road talking about the book. She's in Minneapolis today. We're pleased that she could be with us. Your husband is Indian, that's right?
That's right.
And
yes,
what sort of advice, or did he give you any advice on how you should proceed on doing this project?
Well, I met my husband in 2001, and so suddenly I was working in low-income communities in the United States, whether it was in South Texas or South Boston or Oklahoma City. And then when I'd be finished with my work there, we'd be in India. So, of course, I was curious about, the same questions that I had in the States about who gets out of poverty and why, and what, how do the government programs meant to help people actually get experience on the ground? Those kinds of questions stayed with me when I was in places like Mumbai. And in Mumbai, 60% of the citizenry lives in slums, even despite all the prosperity, 60%. A staggering figure. So but of course I felt I didn't know the culture, so I couldn't write about it. But my husband over time had seen the way I worked on pieces for The New Yorker and seen the way that I try to document with audio tape and photographs and official records. And he would be listening when I would be going through the fact-checking process. And I think he felt that style of documentary reporting might be useful in low-income communities. Because I think, he had a lot of people that he knew and that we knew felt that even though there were some very, very... there was some very serious intellection going on at the top, in Delhi, just as in Washington, there are people who think very hard about how do you get people out of poverty, how do you increase opportunity. He felt that there was a lot of good work being done in the high levels of Indian government but the people didn't really know what was going on the ground. So he felt that it was a reasonable thing to do, and that he felt that I had the skills to do it. So he was. I think it proved much, much harder, I think, emotionally and physically than I expected. But one of the good things is that he helped me believe that it might be worthwhile.
Yeah, I have to ask you the question I know everybody asks, and that is there. Looking at your photograph, there's no one is ever going to. Think that you're an Indian, so nobody's going to mistake you for a member of the community there. So here you would definitely stand out.
Right.
How did you go about trying to build relationships with people and get them to talk to you and get to that point where someone who does this kind of thing get to this point where people almost stop noticing you and go on with their lives even though you're definitely from outside.
Right. Well, and I'd like to say it's some kind of magic charm I have, but it's all it is patience. I would just go and I would come back and I would come back and come back. And then I stopped being the found entertainment. I stopped being the excitement of the day. I just became somebody who was there. One thing I think that afterward people had mentioned to me was that particularly in the beginning, I had a hard time finding a translator who wanted to work as I do over long hours, late at night, in these unpleasant conditions. There was a lot of tuberculosis, a lot of malaria. There were a lot of rats. It was just a difficult. The air was terrible. It was a difficult working environment. So I would just, because I didn't really have anybody to go with, I would go by myself late at night. And even though I lacked, I couldn't speak language, I could still watch people do what they do, and we could communicate the best we could. And people said afterward that made an impression on them, that I wasn't afraid to be there in their community alone or late at night, and they could see that I was really genuinely interested in understanding their world.
Is this a place where there's a lot of crime?
Well, part of what I try to document in the book is that there's more crime than gets documented, and to look at why that is. And so there is crime, but it's often because the crime that happens is often treated as something else because the police don't want to bother to investigate things that happen between low-income people. And one of the things I found haunting and powerful, what I'm trying to convey in the book is that the ways in which people, particularly children, knew that when terrible things happened to their friends, those things would just be covered up and filed away. And what that does, not just to the memory of a friend, but also to the sense that a living child has of how little his life is worth.
We have some other callers here. Why don't we try to talk with some of them? We'll go next to someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes. There is one observation that I have heard about this situation that explains a lot, and it is the belief that reincarnation takes place in that part of the world according to their beliefs. And what they are in a certain position is their own fault because they didn't perform well in their previous life. And that's the reason that they are not helped to get out of that bad situation that they're in, because that's where they belong. And it's their own fault. And that's what I've heard.
Right. I think that sense of this, you know, this was that what you're describing, what was true perhaps several decades ago. But what I find now is that almost nobody believes in the city that nobody really believes that this is where they've been assigned by their gods, and that they are, what, you know, people aren't sitting around waiting for the next life either. They're, particularly the young people, are very, very much actively trying to make their own way in this life. They value this life enormously. And I think there's been a little problem, perhaps, in the ways in which people write about young Indians, that particularly in the West there's an overemphasis on the spiritual and an underestimation of the diversity of people's inner lives, their economic lives, their political lives. So that perhaps the sense that everything is foreordained and everything is deserved has been a little bit exaggerated.
All right, let's go to another caller here, Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning.
Good morning.
A while back, Mr. Inge had another program on India, and I brought up this topic, and I'm not sure it was really fully realized what I was trying to say, and I'd like to bring it up to you. I recently have become more knowledgeable about the Indian culture because of some friends we have. And this friend, the man is a physician, and the woman comes from a very nice family. And he became a physician by working hard and getting his grades up, and his father was an attorney, and he was able to get a scholarship to go to medical school. And once he got out of medical school, he realized, well, there wasn't any money to be made back in the early 70s as a physician in India, so he immigrated to the United States. And he did very, very well here. Don't misunderstand, he's done very well. And he felt as though he owed something to go back to India and give it back, because they'd given him his start. And he stays in touch with India all the time. He still has relatives there, and so he goes regularly. And he's watched over the years, even though he is so successful here in the United States, he's pointed out to me that his peers that started with him back in the 70s, his friends who went to prep school or whatever he went to, have done so well in Bangalore, is where he's from, that he now is not very wealthy. He's, even though he's very wealthy here in the United States, and his group of friends in India, they're doing so phenomenally well,
right,
that he's not a rich man, though here he's a rich man. And
right,
it's just so amazing, the divergence between how well the well are doing and how poor the poor are really doing.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, and what you're saying, that for many people in that, you know, in the elite who've had access to these superb educations in India, their prospects in an economy that's the second fastest growing in the world have been tremendous. And so there's no need anymore for people, for the most affluent and educated, to go places like Britain or the U.S. to make a future, because those economies are shrinking. And so many people have, like your friend's peers, done much better by staying. And in fact, some people who've gone to the United States to make their way are now coming back because they feel the prospects are that much greater for making an immense amount of money.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, there's a question that I wanted to ask, and I wanted to make sure that I understood this or didn't misunderstand, that though as far as the people living in Anawadi were concerned, that officially, as far as the Indian government was concerned, that they were not considered to be poor?
Right, exactly. They were part of, when we talk about the hundreds of thousands of people who have been lifted out of poverty over the course of, since 1991, economic liberalization in India. These are the people of Anawadi, are among the people who are the success stories.
Mm.
And they feel that as well. So one thing that sometimes people might think, oh, the slums, it's all despair, it's all hopelessness, it's an immense amount it's just bristling with hope right now because of the changes in the economy, and just what's painful is how large the obstacles are. But when I describe the large obstacles, also what I'm trying to do is to say that that's not the end of the story, because what's really interesting to me is how people use their imagination to get around obstacles and how they think and retool and reinvent themselves to overcome the barriers to their chances. And it's a volatile, uncertain life, but people are not looking at their economic world with the sense of passiveness or sense of, that they're victims. They're just trying to figure out how to fit into the market economy.
Yeah. Well, and you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there are really three paths out of poverty in a place like this. One would be if you have the entrepreneurial spirit, that can be one way. Taking advantage of government corruption and riding that train can be another. And education is really
right.
the third. And though it seems that certainly a lot has been written about the entrepreneurial spirit and about how hard people work and how they'll find the possibility of some kind of niche that they can occupy and exploit and get themselves up a little bit and then up a little bit more. That though, if by focusing on that, and that is part of the story, though, are we losing something if we're really mostly focusing on that?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think that I mean, my main question, wherever I am, whether it's in India or the United States, is what whose capabilities get supported in a society and whose get squandered, and I think access to education, some kind of functioning education, across the board is extremely important because what kind of entrepreneurship are you? I mean, there are certain people like Abdul who I mean, the fact that Abdul is a teenager, is a great garbage sorter, is because he's been denied every other opportunity. And that's not, to think, oh, well, he's found his way because he can do that really, really well, is not to realize the opportunity cost when you have truly, gifted, creative people who are denied educations. And, what could he have been? What could he be with a little more help?
In the first part of the interview, you talked a little bit about Abdul and his family, and said that really there. And I said that this was the family that was in the main part of the narrative. And you said really there are two. And having just coming off of your last comments about education, I do want to have you talk a little bit about Asha. So here is Asha and his daughter and her daughter really now occupy the other two paths. One, working through politics, and the other trying to take the educational road out
right.
of a place like Anawadi. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about the two of them.
Well, let me tell you about Manju, who, when I first met her, she's a teenager. She was, as everybody said, she's the most everything girl in Anawadi. She was sensitive, she was beautiful, and she was poised to become, at that time, the first female college graduate of all of Anawadi. And she lived in a hut by the sewage lake, the sewage and petrochemicals lake, where she was memorizing the plot summaries of things like Mrs. Dalloway, the Virginia Woolf novel, and Congreve's The Way of the World. And in her spare time, she was also teaching the poorest Anawadi children a few English words. And when I first met Manju, I felt, first of all, I've never read about a young woman like this in the slums, and the second is, how did this young woman get to this point of privilege? And so it takes me back to her mother, because her father was an alcoholic. And in my video, when I look at my videotape footage now, and I'm looking at shots from Manju and her mother and their life, there's almost always some feet sticking in the middle of somewhere, and it's her father passed out. He's just passed out underfoot most of the time, and when he's awake, he's fighting. So Manju's mother single-handedly had to raise three children in the slum and basically do everything she possibly could to give her daughter a better life. And part of what Asha says is that because there's no one reliable springboard out of the slums, you have to try every scheme you can possibly think of to better your life, because you never know which one will work. And so over the course of the book, I show exactly how many schemes she's tried and how the risks that she takes, even with her own body, to make sure that her daughter does get that dream of being the first female college graduate.
So where does one go from there? And where do you go if you're the first female college graduate or the first college graduate of either gender from a place like Anawadi?
Well, if she becomes, her dream, Manju's dream, is to become a teacher, and she's an excellent teacher. And here's the problem for her: is if she wants to get a good permanent job at a government school, she has to pay a mass amount of under the table money to education officials, which she will never have. So she will work in private schools, which are more and more serving more and more the low income people are getting by on very little in order to give their children some kind of low-cost private education, because they've lost faith in the government schools, the public schools' ability to teach their children. So she will probably end up teaching in one of those private schools, and she'll do a good job of it.
And that's, again, this points to the part of the story that's really amazing. And again, it has to do with the the aspiration that people have for themselves and also for their children, that they'll scrape together whatever money that they can and make whatever sacrifices necessary so that they can send their children to the whatever the best school is that they can afford with the money that they have. So the kids, they put on their little school ties and wash up as best as they can, and then they actually they go off to school in the morning.
Right, and the problem is that the parents are often illiterate and they have no idea what the difference, I mean, how to gauge a good school from a bad school. Mm. But still, it's a, you know, I mean, that is, they are sacrificing for the future. And they've seen in their own lives, they've seen, you know, they've seen how far they've come compared to where their parents were. So they, you know, they can just, they feel something that I think people in our country don't feel as strongly as they used to, that their children really will do have an opportunity for a far better life than they had.
I'm sure that we could go to other cities, not only other cities in India, but other cities in other countries, and find places like Anawadi.
Yes, yes. And part of what I'm always say when I come home is people say, oh, you must have culture shock. No, I mean, so much of this is the same.
Well, that's there, and I think more and more is being written about cities now, particularly cities in the developing world, and this, how it is they draw people to them, and they end up in places like Anawadi. So you wonder, is this a story about India, or is this really a much larger story that says something about the global economy?
Right. To me, it's very much a story about the global economy, because I think that wherever I go, more and more people are doing provisional work. And this is just, it's the nature of global, if global capital is restless, it's moving around the planet, it's moving country to country. The commitments that, you know, that makes work more provisional. I don't think this is a temporary phenomenon. I think it's a permanent phenomenon. And I think that whether in most of the low-income communities that I spend time with, that the expectation now is that work is going to be temporary. Mm. I did a story a while back from South Texas, and it was following people after the textile mills closed there. And in South Texas, they had this really intensive job retraining program for some former textile workers. And at the end of it, when they did a study, they found that the most common work for people who'd been retrained was temp work, which was the same as for the people who hadn't taken any retraining at all. So it's, you know, this is the economy that we have now.
Yeah. We're going to have to stop at this point. I'm sorry to cut in on you, but I'm just using my time. And again, I just wanted to say to people, the book is Behind the Beautiful Forevers. It's published by Random House. Our guest, Catherine Boo, is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, David.
And that was an interview from the archive. David conducted that interview on February 20th of this year. Again, Catherine Boo is the author of Behind the Beautiful Forevers.
Support comes from the Klein Center for Democracy on the U of I campus with the 2012 Klein Symposium keynote address, Religious Obstacles to Democratization in the Middle East, Past and Present, by Duke University Professor Timur Kuran, Monday, April 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center Ballroom. Details at kleincenter.illinois.edu. Support comes from 40 North 88 West, presenting the 10th Annual Boneyard Arts Festival, April 19th through 22nd. With venues throughout the county, the festival, in conjunction with the local business community, is a celebration of music, dance, arts, culture, and theater. Information on this year's festival is at 40north.org.
It's 1 minute before noon Central Time. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Let's take a look at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat trading at 6.78. That's down 12. July, 6.87 and a quarter, down 12 and a quarter. May wheat in Chicago down 13 at 6.45. July, 6.55 and three quarters, down 13 and a quarter. May corn, 6.57 and a half, down three quarters. July, 6.51 and three quarters, down one and a quarter. September, 5.65 and three quarters, down two and three quarters. December, 5.43 and a half, down two. May soybeans, 14.26, up 9 1/4. July, 14.29 1/2, up 8 1/4. August, 14.20 1/2, up 7. September, 13.97 1/4, up 4 1/4. May soybean meal, 391.70, up 5.20. May soybean oil, 56.17, up 27. April live cattle, 117.87 1/2, down 192 1/2. June, 114.90, down 115. April feeder cattle, 147.87 1/2, down